Welcome to The Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool. This season focuses on some of the basics of dementia. On today's show, I'll be talking to experts about different dementia subtypes. Dementia is the umbrella term for many different subtypes, with Alzheimer's disease the most common form and usually the most talked about. But let's not forget the many other types of dementia, including Lewy body, vascular, and frontotemporal, to name a few. To help shed some light into the many different types, I'm joined today by two fellow researchers, Anna Faulkner and Riona McArdle, and the Lewy Body Society. Anna is a clinical academic speech and language therapist at UCL. She works as a senior speech and language therapist in the Cognitive Disorders Service at the National Hospital for Neurology, where she diagnoses and treats people with dementia. She leads research in developing interventions to support people with language-led dementia, primary progressive aphasia, and their families in conversation. And she also co-leads the PPA support group and the UK PPA Speech and Language Therapist Network at Rare Dementia Support. Now, we also have Jackie Cannon, who is the CEO of the Lewy Body Society and a former carer for her dad, who lived with Lewy body dementia. And our third panelist today is Riona McArdle. She's an NIHR Advanced Fellow at Newcastle University. Her research ambition is to improve how we diagnose and care for people with dementia through novel applications of digital healthcare. She's led the largest study to date to examine patterns of gait in Lewy body dementia and Alzheimer's disease using wearable technology in clinical and real-world environments. So there'll be more to share about those fantastic panelists today, but first of all, just welcome the three of you on this show.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
All of you come from quite different backgrounds, not just in terms of research, but also from a charity and personal background, which is great because we can talk about one topic from all the different angles. So when looking at rarer forms of dementia, Anna, your background is speech and language from a clinical point of view. How did you come to focus on rarer dementias?
It's a really good question. So I get asked this question quite a lot, actually, because as a speech and language therapist, you train to work with adults and children. So you get this broad training. I specialised in working with adults very quickly, immediately after my training. And I actually, having trained at UCL, having grown up in London, gone to university in London, started working in London, I wanted to go further afield and I started traveling a bit. I went over to Australia and I worked in Melbourne for 5 years. And it was over in Melbourne in the late 2000s, I think it was 2008, I was working at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and seeing outpatients. And in Australia, I mean, it happens in the UK as well, but you get referrals often from more rural areas where therapists don't feel confident with rarer conditions. And we started receiving lots of referrals for people with a rare progressive language-led dementia, so primary progressive aphasia, from therapists who didn't know what to do with these clients. And we started providing a therapy outpatient program for these clients because we felt this was an area of need that nobody else was fulfilling in Melbourne, in Australia at the time. And it wasn't long afterwards that I came back to the UK and I thought I'll come back home, come back to London, the epicenter of the universe. And and of course, they'll know all about PPA and they'll know what to do with it, which when I got back to the UK and started working in the NHS, I found out, of course, was not the case. And so I realised that there was still a huge need in England as well and across the world. And I thought one of the ways I could share my clinical knowledge I'd gained was to write a resource, a book for speech and language therapists clinically. And as I started doing that, I felt more and more confident about the idea that actually what I perhaps might really like to do is do some research to fill this gap, because I realized through writing the book, through really immersing myself in the research evidence, how little, basically, how there was no real intervention research for this client group. So that's what motivated me to work with this particular client group, which I also feel, having worked with this client group, is an area of expanding need. I think we've I've spoken about primary progressive aphasia, which is a subgroup, if you will, within the frontotemporal and Alzheimer's disease spectrum. But actually, secondary progressive aphasia, or having a progressive aphasia as a secondary symptom or third symptom, is really increasingly recognized as something that affects people with Lewy body dementia, with typical Alzheimer's, with other rarer atypical Alzheimer's such as posterior cortical atrophy, vascular dementia. So actually, I think there's a much bigger need for speech and language therapists to deliver interventions to this client group.
And I suppose it's a symptom, isn't it? Not necessarily of every subtype, but speech and difficulties with language is not just for a language-specific dementia, but it can cover different types.
Precisely. Absolutely. Yeah. And speech, so problems with articulation, a strength range of movement or coordination, or language difficulties, thinking of words, forming grammar, understanding information, but equally cognitive communication difficulties, so difficulties in judgment and topic maintenance. They're all conditions that actually impact conversation as well. And if we look at it rather than in terms of the siloed idea of it being a symptom of speech or a symptom of language, if we look at the functional activity of conversation, interaction, relationships, this is something that probably impacts almost everyone with dementia that we see.
And I remember when I was interviewing a person living with semantic dementia, and he was in the moderate to advanced stages. And I vividly remember this as, you know, sometimes when you see participants or patients, you remember them years after, because I was personally so, I struggled dealing with it afterwards, because you could tell, and his wife could tell, he still knows everything in his mind. He just can't produce the words for it. And it seemed like he's in his own little prison in a way, is because of that language.
Yeah, you've just really beautifully described the frustration that so many of the clients I work with feel, who are trying to connect. It's not often not that they don't want to, they really want to, or they want to have a relationship. It's just they're not, and the people around them, you talked about his wife, who are often there trying to support their loved ones, care for their loved ones. Somebody recently said to me, who I've known since the very beginning of their journey, and they're now much, much further along their journey, and the husband said to me, I thought communication was important at the beginning of my journey. I've now realized that communication is absolutely essential the further along I get into this journey with my wife.
Absolutely. And maybe just to follow up on that, in terms of speech, language, communication, do you feel it's used adequately in the diagnosis process, or should there be done more?
It's a really good question. I've not been asked that one before. I would say that I think speech and language therapists should be used more in the diagnostic process, because we are trained specifically to diagnose between different types of speech and language and cognitive impairment that can be and are known to be associated with different types of dementia. And often we see these clients all the time. You know, we see people with different types of language impairment all the time, be it difficulties accessing semantics, so word meanings versus word forms, so their lexicon versus the phonemes, so the speech sounds. So we're used to differentiating between these different levels of language and speech breakdown, whereas there'll be other professionals, medical, nursing, who perhaps don't have the experience of having seen so many, who could really benefit from that collaborative work that we can offer. So I'd probably articulate it that way around. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no. That's why you come on this podcast. You get new questions for you.
Love it. It's great.
that's great. So looking at it, and you were referring to Lewy body dementia there as well. And we've got the CEO of the Lewy body Society on this podcast today. So Great to see you as always, Jackie. We see each other a lot in the past 2 years on our research. So I feel like since working with you and working with the society on these different projects, I feel I personally know much more about Lewy body dementia as a subtype. But what would you tell someone who's never heard of this form of dementia before? What is it?
What I would tell them is that we hear this word dementia, and Lewy body dementia is not about memory, because people automatically think memory when we talk about dementia. This is about those cognitive behaviours. It's about the hallucinations, the delusions, the paranoia. And not everybody will experience those symptoms to the same degree. You know, this disease or this illness, it really is as individual as the person that's living with it. You know, people will have those core symptoms to such varying degrees. Some people will experience tremors associated with Parkinson's. Some people will have no tremors, like my dad. But years before he was diagnosed, he shuffled his feet when he walked. And that was probably like 20 years before the hallucinations started. And I would say to people that people will have moments of complete clarity, that it's like flicking a light switch. Somebody can zoom out, but then they will be back with you and you will have a perfectly normal conversation. And I think it's so important that people get the correct diagnosis of the subtype, because if not, those people, you can't support them in living well, because people with Lewy body have specific needs, have specific requirements, specific support requirements, and you will only get that with the correct diagnosis. And I believe that research has shown that 51% of people with a diagnosis of Lewy body dementia have had a previous diagnosis of something else, whether it's another form of dementia or another illness.
So it's definitely something that's more difficult, I suppose, or lack of awareness maybe in professionals?
I would suggest it's lack of awareness rather than difficult to diagnose, because there are clear guidelines, and you only have to look at the Diamond Lewy Project and the checklist that is readily there available to diagnose Lewy body dementia, even without a scan. There is a complete checklist, and as part of that checklist, it's so important to speak to the caregiver to understand those symptoms, for example, like lack of REM sleep.
So then if you say that someone gets this misdiagnosis, I suppose it can often be a couple of years or something until they get the right diagnosis, which then leaves them without the right care, doesn't it?
I think so. I think even before COVID world, people were on average taking like 3 years in some areas to get a diagnosis. You know, it really is kind of depending on where you live, the medical professionals that you see. Some people will get a diagnosis and be very successfully diagnosed. But I would suggest that for a high proportion of people, it can be that 3 years on average.
Way too long. It leaves people without the right care for too long. And I know that as part of your role at the society, you speak to a lot of family carers and about their experiences also, especially throughout COVID, and there's been even more upsetting experiences, I suppose. Do you feel there's enough in relation to the general population, and I suppose in relation to carers and families, do you feel there's enough awareness of Lewy body dementia out there, but also support for Lewy body dementia?
No. The first time that the vast majority of family carers and people receiving that diagnosis have ever heard of Lewy body dementia is when that diagnosis is given to them. I've seen an increased number of people ringing us because they're just given the diagnosis and there's no post-diagnostic support, not even being signposted to organisations that can help them.
Okay.
And you know, that is a really big thing. And then where you've got a lot of people who have a probable diagnosis of Lewy body dementia, they're waiting for an appointment, and we get calls, how can we speed this up? Can we get a referral to a private consultant? Because people just really don't know where to turn. And that's not trying to paint a negative picture. It's just the struggle that people need to get this diagnosis, because a lot of people actually feel relieved once they've got the diagnosis, because at least they know what they're dealing with and they can put things in place and they can get the right support. And, you know, very importantly, get the right medication, because as we know, there's no drug license specifically for Lewy body dementia.
I suppose if there's this lack of awareness as well, as you were saying, that it's usually the first time that people hear about Lewy body dementia at the point of diagnosis. But if people were more aware of these different symptoms, and we know from Lewy body specifically motor difficulties as well and gait, you were saying your father was shuffling his feet well before getting hallucinations earlier, maybe then the dementia could be picked up better as well, because I suppose at the moment everyone still thinks, oh, people just have Alzheimer's disease dementia, people just have memory problems, people just forget how to make a hot meal or get dressed or something. It's not just that. And as you were saying, Anna, about the language as well, and Riona, your research looks particularly at these motor difficulties and gait. Do you want to share a bit more about that and those symptoms?
So my research, is this question for me? Yes, sorry.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. You probably want to cut this small portion out. It's just my dog has been howling in the background, so it's a bit hard to hear. So my research really focuses on looking at how people move and trying to figure out how we can use that to inform diagnosis and inform care plans for people with different types of dementia. And the start of this work was really during my PhD at Newcastle University. And my goal during that PhD was to find out if people with Lewy body dementias have unique walking patterns in comparison from Alzheimer's disease. And the reason for that is, as Jackie says, it is people with dementia with Lewy bodies are very underdiagnosed part of the dementia population. I believe that they are only around 2-4% of all of the clinical cases of dementia in the UK, but on pathology, they're 15%. So that's quite a big variation. And there's been a lot of work that's shown, you know, it's really regional differences that is showing up there. It's really under application of the diagnostic criteria, which has been used. And it's kind of a lack of clinical awareness of people themselves when they go into that diagnostic process. Most people think Alzheimer's rather than the rarer forms of dementia. So we really wanted to find a way that would be able to help easily identify if someone might have Lewy body dementia in comparison to Alzheimer's. And the way that we wanted to look at that was to do with mobility. So we often think that, you know, the way a person walks is just a very simple process. You don't really need to think about it. It's pretty easy for us to do. But as people go through the process of cognitive decline, it gets much, much harder for them to be able to walk in a safe way, because it actually does require quite a lot of complex cognitive processes. So if you can imagine when you're walking around, you know, a shopping center, there's a lot of, you know, moving targets coming at you, and your brain is very quickly telling you how to adapt yourself to that. But as cognition begins to decline, you may not be able to do that anymore. You might not be able to do it as safely. And so I can look at things like that, very small, subtle symptoms of movement problems. And I can do that using technology and very fancy gait analysis equipment and slightly less fancy wearable technology equipment as well. So that's kind of what I wanted to do with my PhD. We found that people with Lewy body dementia do have unique signatures of gait impairment. So they walk slower with shorter steps, which we kind of makes sense from what Jackie said. You know, they have a shuffling gait, but they're also more variable as they're walking, which means they're probably not adapting their steps very well to their environment. And they're also more asymmetric when they're walking. So one of their feet is moving slightly differently to the other, and that can cause all kinds of problems as well. And it might be reflecting some of the processes that's going on within the brain. And we did that in a big gait lab, which is very expensive to do and requires specialist expertise to do that. And so that wouldn't be put into a clinic. But we did translate those findings then into small wearable technology that can be worn just in a lab or in a clinic, but it can also be worn out in the real world and can collect data in the real world. And that opened up implications. Now, this is, you know, the kind of the first work. So it's the first bit of evidence that says, hey, this might be useful for you to use. But because you can look at it in the real world, it also opens up a whole pathway for care, because that means that we could monitor how people are getting on after their diagnosis. We can start to adapt things. And it's really important for mobility, because as we've been talking about, dementia isn't just memory. It is so much more than memory, and mobility is a huge part of it. People with dementia are 3 times more likely to fall than people who don't have dementia of the same age group. And those falls can lead them to get into hospital and get into all sorts of really dangerous situations. So we might be able to monitor that by using this kind of wearable technology. And that's sort of the area that I'm kind of now working in as well. So I'm trying to cross over from the diagnostic to post-diagnostic space, because if we are getting better at diagnosing people, then we need to absolutely make sure that they have the appropriate care pathway that they go into afterwards.
Absolutely. I've spoken to some other carers before, but there's usually very little information given either at the point of diagnosis or throughout. Sometimes people are inundated with, here's a lot of information, but it's just not the right time point. It's so upsetting. It's just a little trauma, I suppose, dealing with that diagnosis, and they can't soak up all the information. So it should really be like a piecemeal approach, little bits of information throughout. But this is really important, like you were saying, if you do find out how gait develops, how motor functioning develops, then people should be aware of that in a way to plan. And I suppose, does that also link to home adaptations? Have you looked at that? If people have motor difficulties, does that imply they need to have their home modified maybe a bit differently in Lewy body dementia or earlier than other subtypes?
I haven't specifically looked at that yet, though I would absolutely love to look at that. And I am trying to find a way to look at that. But I know that in other types of dementia, for example, like posterior cortical atrophy, where they have a lot of visual perceptual problems and they've really struggled to see the environment around them, they do require home adaptations. And that's something that you would probably see coming through in their mobility as well. I would imagine that for a person with Lewy body dementia, a very cluttered environment, for example, would be an incredibly unsafe place for them to be moving around. I'm sure Jackie knows quite a lot about this from her lived experience of the situation. One of the things that we did see in my study, and that we do see when we, you know, talk to people with dementia or carers, is that often as people with dementia begin to have unsafe walking behaviours, it's felt that it's safer for them to not be moving. And that leads to even more difficulties, because if you're not moving, you're becoming frailer. If you do end up having a fall, it's going to have a much higher cost for you to have. So we don't really want people with dementia to be sitting in their chairs all day, but that is what happens as the disease progresses, because it's just felt that that's just a safer place for them to be in. But it means that their independence gets taken away from them quite quickly. And we know that when we speak to carers or people with dementia, that that loss of mobility, whether it's their own choice to lose that mobility or whether it's because they are now too impaired to move that easily, is massive to taking away their independence. It makes them really upset. It's very frustrating for them. And they really begin to lose that sense of purpose for themselves. So, you know, I do really feel very similar to what Anna said about communication. It is such a central thing to try to help people maintain as they go through their dementia journey.
Anna, did you want to? Yeah.
I did. And I wanted to just link up what everyone's been saying, because I think it's been such a neat podcast, Clarissa, that you've organized with all three of us.
Thank you so much.
Emphasize the key roles that research, clinical and charities have. And I think in the past there's been a real nihilistic attitude within some of the health professions who gatekeep services because there's no research evidencing that they work. So then people try and keep their family members safe, and then charities have to spring up because there's no one else to give advice. And what we need is more evidence, more so that people can navigate healthcare services and be guided through with care pathways that can be advocated and co-produced by people with lived experience. I think there's a bigger package of work that we all need to do that we're all working towards concurrently. And it's just been a delightful, I think, curation of the podcast today, because I think you've really brought that together with bringing us three together. Thank you.
Thanks, Anna. A little pat on the shoulder there, cheers. I like bringing together people with those different backgrounds and thoughts, because then we actually come to something that we wouldn't just get if it was just I don't know, social care researchers or just charity or just, I don't know, carers, for example. But you picked up on something, Riona, as well, in terms of the, let's not just keep people sitting in the chair because it's safe. And what I was just thinking about as well, we've witnessed throughout the past 2 years, in particular with the pandemic, there's been, particularly in the beginning, that lack of social stimulation, that lack of cognitive stimulation, but also the physical stimulation was lacking. So normally someone would go out for a walk or something or go to their social activities. None of that pretty much happened. And we've noticed so much faster deteriorations in people living with dementia. So it's really about highlighting again, it's important to enable people to be as active in a safe environment as possible, which is why we need these specific supports for each subtype. So you were just talking about more the Lewy body dementia, but Anna, can you think from your research and clinical work, is there any specific support and care that you'd suggest for specific subtypes like the ones you were working on that may differ from Alzheimer's disease, for example?
When it comes to interventions, there are a couple of different approaches that Riona has started alluding to, really, insofar as there's some interventions that can maintain function. So, for example, more exercise-based, even with speech and language, as well as mobility. And there's some interventions that need to be delivered to compensate, as Riona was saying, moving furniture around or providing a walking stick. Similarly, speech and language, we might be looking at communication aids, and they may take the form of more high technology aids that can speak for you. You might have seen on the news recently, on the BBC, somebody talking about voice banking. And that voice banking is a really broad umbrella term that we as speech and language therapists do a lot of different types of voice banking to enable people to use speech and communicate and interact through compensatory measures. But then there's also working on the environment, which really overlaps a little bit with some of those strategies. And so I often work with the people around the person who are often the ones who, in actual fact, most often get left out, I would say, that especially at the beginning, it's all about the person, and the people around the person are left to just do what they feel might be the right thing. So I have found investing in the research that I do has really focused on what we call communication partner training. We actually work with people and their family members together. So as a team, to negotiate jointly what strategies are going to help the person have a better conversation. So have a conversation that flows, have an interaction that flows, and what can the family members do to facilitate that? But what does the person also need to do to facilitate that? So it's a collaborative, joined up approach. And we use lots of video recording to look at people's conversations and interactions and work out what people are already using, because what we tend to find is that people who are living with progressive conditions have been compensating, as Jackie mentioned. Symptoms will appear for many years before a diagnosis, and people start subtly compensating. And often actually the best way for us as clinicians to work is to tweak what a person's already been doing. That's, we know from behavior change theory that that's going to provide most success. So a lot of what we do with communication partner training is based in behavior change theory, based in conversation analysis, which we do a lot of video recording of natural conversations. We're slowly working towards body-worn devices. It's a bit trickier when you want to video recordings of conversations going on in natural life, because people are a bit less sure about walking around with video cameras on them. But we're finding ways of doing that. And we're finding that the interventions we're developing are highly accepted right from the beginning. People want them as early as possible. They're really acceptable to the people, their family members, the clinicians who are delivering them. We found that on a lot of the measures we're using, they are successful. So people are achieving their goals. People are feeling more confident. They're changing their behaviours. And slowly, we're also finding that actually people have, as they've had them at the beginning stages, these kind of interventions, that it's an investment. It fits with things like the NHS long-term care plan to be working on self-management and self-care. So I would say, I've given you a really long waffling answer. And I would say the key is to start early.
Yeah.
Interventions, and to invest in the person and the people around them. No matter, and I'd say that's probably true whether you're working on communication or anything else.
Jackie, I'm mindful that you've got two hats on today, with your former caring role and with your society role. You hear these chats about Riona's work and about Anna's work and Anna's clinical work as well. Do you feel it's different these days, the care and the knowledge that's out there compared to when you were providing care for your dad?
Absolutely, because we weren't aware of all the research that is now currently going on. But I still do feel that Lewy body dementia is still and remains the most common type of dementia that people have never heard of. We have still got such a long way to educate the general public and to educate medical professionals. You know, I think as the other panelists have said today, that this type of dementia has the greatest carer burden. People are more likely to be hospitalised. So the more that we can do to help people live well, to understand the disease, to get that correct diagnosis, because there are so many people struggling just to get that diagnosis. So they can't even put all this other good stuff in place. So I do feel disappointed in some respects that after 12 years that we've still got such a long, long way to go to make this not the most common type of dementia that you've never heard of. It should be as widely known as other forms of dementia.
Hopefully this podcast does a little bit for that. Even if it's just a handful of people who afterwards think, oh yeah, I now know what Lewy body
dementia is. Absolutely. Thank you.
But you've kind of answered my last question there to you all as well, Jackie, which is great. So just if we think about, I mean, rarer dementias is huge, and there's too many to mention. But what would you say is the key thing that should be focused on in rare dementias as a next thing? What should we focus on next, Riona?
I am really interested actually in the area of ensuring, it's kind of what Anna said earlier, of ensuring that when we're caring for a person with a rare dementia or any dementia, but for me, Lewy body dementia springs to mind because that's where my experience really comes from, that we are making sure that we're also caring for the carer at the same time. And that's something that I'm now really interested in. And I'm very interested in the psychological impact of receiving a diagnosis of dementia and what that does to the person with dementia and the carer, and then what impact that has on how they're living their life afterwards. Because what I noticed from working with people with Lewy body dementia, especially because of the high carer burden that we talk about and the very hands-on role that that caregiving leads to very quickly in the course of the disease, is that, you know, if a carer is very burnt out and very stressed out, it's going to have a huge impact on that person with dementia. It's going to lead to, you know, exactly what I said in the mobility space. If you are terrified that your partner is going to fall down if they're moving around trying to help with housework that they could do, then you're going to tell them to sit in a chair. And when you do that, they're going to lose stimulation, they're going to lose their independence, and they're going to decline at a faster rate. So I think it's really important that we are able to keep people independent and in their own homes for as long as possible, but that we're doing that while maintaining the well-being of both partners in that. You don't want to keep someone in their own home at the expense of the person who's caring for them being incredibly burnt out and leading to actually a worse caring practice for that person with dementia. So in a long-winded way, I think what we really need to do is make sure that there's dual support coming in, especially thinking about dementias where the progress might be very, very fast, or where the caregiving role might evolve very quickly, and making sure that we are really preparing people for that. We're offering counselling for them at that point of diagnosis. And we're really understanding how the psychology of receiving a diagnosis of dementia is going to impact everything in those people's lives after that point.
I think also absolutely echoing that, also in terms of young onset dementia as well. Now, that's not necessarily a subtype, it's more age categorization. There's many different subtypes within that, but just facing that, I don't know, your husband, your boyfriend, whoever, your wife gets a diagnosis at age 45 or something, when you're in the midst of having a career, maybe kids, maybe have other caring duties. It's completely different psychological mindset than when you receive that diagnosis of your loved one in their 80s or something. So definitely carers should be supported. What about you, Anna? What do you think is the key thing that should be focused on?
I think, alongside what Fiona has said, that actually these rarer dementias provide extreme phenotypes that we can learn from and transfer to the more common dementias. And I'm saying that as a sales pitch, because I think that often the rarer dementias are the poorer cousins, because it's considered, well, it's less prevalent, why should we invest money in it? Whereas if we can demonstrate that we can learn from these extreme phenotypes, and that will impact the wider burden of dementia, that could be a really useful way to gain further investment in care, research, and pathways for people. But in terms of communication, I think that we also need to look more at care and clinical impacts, because I think that in general, the research investment as a researcher has been all in the cure domain. And I think we all understand that that very sadly is much further away than we'd like it to be. And in the meantime, there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people who need to live with this, and lots of families who need to live with this. And I'm sure Riona has experienced the same, and yourself, but I've, as somebody who does research in care, there's only a very small number of opportunities for funding.
And highly competitive ones, usually that, rejected.
Exactly. And yet this seems like a no-brainer that we should be investing in this area.
Can I just pop in with 2 points there, which just basically agree with Anna, but on Anna's second point, I think as well, like, a lot of the treatment and drug options and cure is going towards Alzheimer's because it's the most common type. But even if they do cure Alzheimer's tomorrow, that's not going to answer the question for those rare dementias. And it's so important that we have the right care pathway for them. And what Anna said about how we could take things that we do with rare dementias and learn how we can use that for dementia in general, you can really see that kind of happening with the mobility space. So, for example, I'm sure in the 90s, in the diagnostic criteria for Alzheimer's disease, it said that if they had any problems at walking, then it wasn't Alzheimer's disease. We know that's not the case now in mobility research. We know that people with Alzheimer's disease have significant walking problems in comparison to older adults that don't have any cognitive problems. They're really high falls risk, and they do face the same kind of problems that someone with Lewy body dementia would have with mobility. It's just a little bit further down the pathway for them, and we're not preparing them for that. So it's really important to take those kind of things. You know, often symptoms that happen in rare dementias will be seen in more common dementias. It's just a little bit later on, and we could really be doing these interventions very early that we've developed for the rare dementias. So I just wanted to agree with Anna. I think it's a really important point. And, you know, any research that we're doing in rarer dementia spaces will probably be transferable to the broader dementia space anyway.
I like that highlighting pitch, but absolutely true what we learned from those rarer types. And I can see Jackie nodding her hat in our virtual podcast here. Yes, we can always take that transferable knowledge to the more common type of dementia, or more broadly. But then again, also what we learned from dementia, I've noticed recently from some of my students, it can be transferred to other population groups as well at times. So I think that's really key to have that crossover knowledge. But it's been an absolute pleasure talking to all of you. Thank you so much. If you want to learn more about what Anna's and Riona's research is focusing on, or the Lewy Body Society, have a look at the bio with more details. And for more discussion into the basics of dementia, have a listen to my next few podcasts. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much, Clarissa.
Thank you.